Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Ewlings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Ewlings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists, to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Our guest today is Christina DiChiara. Christina has spent over 10 years creating and implementing business workshops, most recently in partnership with Assets for Artists at RISCA, the Rhode Island State Council on the Arts, in partnership with MassMoCA, that's Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art. She's now moving into a new role as the Visual Arts Development Manager at Brown University, where she'll continue to work with artists in developing their professional practices. Welcome to the show, Christina. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about yourself and what you do for a living and why it's important?
Hi, Daniel. Yeah, thank you. So as you mentioned, I had worked for the Rhode Island State Council on the Arts for over a decade. And while I was there, my job was to find resources for artists, to provide services to artists, to run grant programs for artists. And so I was always looking for anything that I could find that might help artists in their careers and on their path. And it was exciting years ago to find the Clark Ewlings Fund. I think I found your organization when you had just pretty much started and saw that you had a grant program for artists and professional development workshops for artists. And since I had been running professional development workshops for artists at RISCA for so many years, it was great to connect with you. And in the process of running grant workshops for artists over the years, I've just become sort of a repository of information about professional development for artists. I've worked with the best in the field in our region on issues like legal issues for artists, marketing for artists, copyright and finances, and now partnering with MassMoCA, I've really been privileged to learn from the best about how artists can save for their personal goals, invest in their own arts business, and market themselves. And in this day and age, artists really do have to be their own personal business office. And so I feel like I've really gotten to know that piece of the career of artists. And so I'm happy to share that today. My parents are both in the arts. They run an opera company in Michigan called the Michigan Opera Theater. And so I've always been in the arts realm. And now as the department manager for visual arts at Brown, again, I'm excited to be working in the arts and working with artists, some very established in our wonderful faculty, and then students who are just making their way into the arts world.
So let me ask you, what has been the artists and business community's responses to these workshops? Were they receptive? You know, you tell me about it.
When I first started creating a professional artist development program in Rhode Island, my first step was to seek out the resources that existed in the state because, you know, whenever you don't have to duplicate efforts, it's best to work with what's there. And I sought resources for business development through organizations like the Small Business Administration or Women and Enterprise, or there's a group of retired professionals who give business advice. There's a whole bunch of resources that you can probably find in any state that help entrepreneurs start and run their businesses. And I really found within my first couple of years of running the program that in some instances, combining arts and business can be putting a square peg in a round hole. And there were some professional resources that were just not a good fit for arts businesses. And sometimes that would be people who would come into a workshop that I was coordinating with them and have an attitude like, oh, flaky artists, they don't know what they're doing. I'm going to come in here and I'm going to shape them up and tell them what they have to do. Other times, it might be that they were presenting an approach to business that just wasn't a good fit for the arts. You know, artists are not looking to create a company and then sell it to an angel investor. Your art is your life, you know, your art is really you. And it took me a couple of years of hit or miss and really digging deep into who was in the region to find wonderful professionals who were both knowledgeable about arts and about business. And I feel like when you find those people and those organizations and those resources, that have created something new. It's not just about applying business practices to the arts. It's really about that new beast that is the union of an artistic approach to life, artistic goals, and good professional practices that you found a wonderful resource. So over time, I found enough of those wonderful resources and then finally partnered with Assets for Artists so that I felt like we were on to something and that we weren't trying to force an approach to doing business on artists that just wasn't a good fit for them.
So, Christina, I'm curious about how you developed topics for this program. You know, we talk about professional development and the business side of arts sort of in generalities and theory. But, you know, did you have a way of choosing particular topics, you know, for instance, on the financial end or the legal end or other, you know, sales or other aspects of it?
When I created the first iteration of Rhode Island's professional development program, I had been working at the council already for about 4 years. And by that time, I had started to glean from artists what it was that they needed and was asking people, if we created a professional development program, what would you need? And part of what they needed, and this is sort of a side thing, but definitely tied to Clark Hewling, is some microfunds in order to pay for specific business expenses. So when I first started our program, there was also a micro grant attached to it. So if you needed to buy software or hire some legal counsel or something like that. So I know Clark Hewling has some funds for artists for things like shipping art and travel, and those things are priceless. But I started getting topics from them. And of course, marketing is on everyone's mind, how to get their work out there. And copyright. Artists are always really concerned about legal issues, copyright contracts. So I just started collecting topics. And then after that, it was a matter of matching topics to resources and seeing where I could satisfy what they needed.
Yeah, so that's a very similar trajectory to what the Clark Hewling Fund has done with our Business Accelerator program. You know, of course, what we do is we pair educational programs with tools, introductions, media, and funding at critical moments for artists. And of course, you know, my background, I have a master's in education. I act actually as educational director for the fund. So I'm a core designer on our accelerator program. And of course, we've done very much the same. We've done the needs assessment, and then it's a matter of staffing that with core talent that can both communicate as a subject matter expert, but also specifically to artists. Again, as you gave the example of we're not trying to cash out of our businesses as artists. So we have to get the person that's familiar with sort of the art industry. So yeah, I'm very impressed that, you know, we sort of have these core similarities. I wonder, though, you know, we use the term early on, professional practice, in this discussion to refer to the business side of art. Have you experienced artists shying away from the notion, if we state it more clearly, that art is a business and that the rules and principles of operating a business actually do apply?
An interesting question. So what I would say is that we are somewhat in a new era where we cannot expect an outside entity to do everything for us. And of course, this isn't just the case in the arts, this is the case everywhere. We no longer have a presumption of, you know, pensions and, you know, things like that we used to. We're all always sort of piecing together how we're going to have careers throughout our lives now in a way that didn't used to be the case. But in the past, I think artists' ultimate goal was to get a gallery that would represent them. And then that gallery would handle sales, and it would handle events, and it would handle marketing, and it would handle finances, and they would just be able to make their art. And I feel like that is somewhat a thing of the past. And now, with the advent of technology and with the advent of the internet, people really are becoming their own marketing team and their own business platform. And I think that that is a new reality. And when I created this program, I think I was starting to see, unfortunately, Rhode Island, we don't have a lot of very big galleries. We do have some wonderful galleries that serve artists beautifully, but we don't have big gallery institutions that float artists' careers. And even if those do exist in other areas, those organizations more and more, those businesses more and more expect artists to pull some of their weight, particularly with marketing and getting their name out there. So it's just necessary now for artists to have those skills.
Let me ask you this. Has running business workshops for artists changed the way that you've come to view, aside from what you said about this evolution, has it changed the way you've come to view the arts industry or artists themselves?
Another lens that I have into this is way back in the day, I used to make artwork, but now I have a full-time job and a child, so I don't make my own art as much as I'd like to. But my husband is a full-time painter as well as a gallery manager. And every time I would run a workshop or design a new workshop, I would always be guiding it or sitting through it with an ear to my husband's career and thinking, how would he do this? How does this apply to his work as an artist? So I feel like there is just a necessity for anyone who's running these workshops or artists themselves to just be very empathetic and understanding about the need for this combination of combining the arts and the professional practice.
So I want to ask you next, why is it that artists and arts organizations are just now starting to consider the professional or the business development of artists rather than solely focusing on their artistic practice? I mean, I get that there's this evolution where we can no longer be dependent, but I mean, some people do choose just abject dependency. It's almost like choosing poverty, but they do choose dependency. And it was never really true that artists had a golden age where they never had to, they were rife with cash and opportunities and all their marketing was done for them and they never had to consider the business side of things. That hasn't really evolved. You've always needed that. So why now are we moving toward this?
Yeah, and of course, I can only speak to my current time. So I do know that many artists, just as you said, you know, I don't know if it's true that there was never a time that they could completely rely on galleries. Maybe it's my own presumption. I feel like there was this age of the professional gallery when artists could expect on a bigger level than they can now for a gallery to be their business office, be their marketing office, and that exists less now. But maybe it's the profusion of the internet and the profusion of technological resources now that really allow artists to do much more to promote themselves and to do much more to manage their own affairs. You know, some artists who I've worked with through our workshop, through Risk is Workshops, you know, they will resist wanting to run their own business or they will resist wanting to promote themselves. Sometimes artists just get overwhelmed by social media or they get overwhelmed by, you know, multiple platforms that they can use. And when you give them a little introduction to how platforms can cross-reference each other or how maybe if you're doing zero marketing now, just once a month is a way to get yourself started. And so if you present it to them in a way that feels manageable, it can have a huge impact and suddenly they can feel very empowered. So I don't know whether it's a change in necessity or a change in opportunity, but artists can be very much their own business office and they can be very much their own marketing engine in a way that they could not in the past, and I feel like in a way that you just have to be in this day and age.
Well, I certainly agree with you that technology has changed everything. You know, as a digital ecologist, one of the things that I have to take stock of is that everyone is a creator now. Media now belongs to everyone. That's really the Arab Spring. You know, we're all essentially citizen reporters, but we're all also artists in some sense. And of course, this is being decried a lot by sort of traditionalists, and I get it. There's a lot of bad art being produced because now anyone can produce art and try to build an audience around it and display it. I don't think that's really much of a concern, but I suppose that's probably part of what's driving the lack of a guarantee and the need now to be sort of prolific to reach people. But part of it seems to be that you can now buy art without going through the gallery. You can buy art directly from the artist so much easier. I can get online and order a work from Estonia directly from the artist's studio with whom I'm connected on Facebook and who I have email exchanges with about how to properly frame his art and care for it and so on, you know? And it's just an unprecedented set of relationships that don't require me to physically leave my office. You don't have to participate in that, but, you know, it's waiting and ignoring it is sort of leaving money and opportunity on the table. I'm wondering, though, if you think that this is an actual cultural change or if we're just looking at a moment in time and this is going to evaporate. And I ask you this because I think some artists are waiting for it, hoping it will go away. And I don't see it going away. What do you think?
Well, just like you said before, you were talking about being able to have email exchanges with an artist from Estonia. I have no idea what the future holds. But one thing that has held true probably forever, and is definitely the case still today, is that arts professionals are unique in that their product, their business, their service is directly tied to themselves. So you certainly can sell a painting sight unseen, you know, artist sight unseen, just because someone thinks that your painting is nice and they buy it. But that painting is still a very deep reflection of you. And it is more likely that someone is going to want to buy either one painting or continue to collect your work, or if you're a musician, continue to, you know, follow your career, because they're interested in you. So your paintings and your music are going to reflect what you're interested in and your approach to the world and the genres that you are influenced by. And the more people know about you and why you're interested in those topics and why those genres influence you, the more they're going to want to buy your CDs or buy your paintings or even just go to your shows. So it's probably not going to change anytime soon that is the case, because I think that that is what is essential to the arts, that people are interested in artists not just because they create a product, but because of everything that they are that goes into that product. And as you said, it helps to be prolific if you can reach out to multiple audiences to want to engage with your work. But on the opposite side, we also, because of the internet, are in a day and age where it's not just that you're prolific, but it's that you might do something very specific and you can find your audience. You can find the people out there who are interested in that thing in a way that just never was popular and it was never possible in the past. So I don't know what the future holds, but artists, their person, who they are, and how they connect with people is really what their artwork is about, and I think is the key to how they build their audience and how they build their market.
I want to take this moment to mention that the Clark Hulings Fund delivers podcast courses like this at the pleasure of our audience. That means if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 a month would be a welcome and appropriate way to sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Know also that a portion of our funding goes to deliver direct education to artists who've demonstrated a clear, achievable plan for transforming their businesses into self-sustaining and thriving ones that fill the world with art. Share this commitment with us now at clarkhulingsfund.org/thrive. That's clarkhulingsfund.org/thrive. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Christina, I want to ask you, since building these workshops or sponsoring these workshops, have you noticed a shift in the perspective of the artists that are attending? Are their questions different? You know, are a new generation of artists more or less willing to embrace these ideas and self-promotion in a way? And I have a reason for asking you this, but I'll let you answer.
I would say that I did get a little bit more resistance in the early years of the program, which was, you know, 2006, 2007, 2008, I want to say, and mostly around social media. I had a lot of artists who just were not comfortable with really getting on board with social media, multiple platforms, much less just one. And that has changed. I think now every artist has integrated social media into their practice, whether everyone does it regularly, you know, that's to be seen. But there isn't anybody who you're going to talk to now who doesn't understand that they have to have an internet presence. Beyond that, you know, legal issues I feel like are always fraught with misunderstanding. And I feel like we could run our same legal shop workshop, which we do in partnership with, I keep saying we, I'm not at risk anymore, which the Arts Council and Assets for Artists do in partnership with the Arts and Business Council of Greater Boston, which is a wonderful organization. I feel like artists can use a 101 legal primer year after year after year, and they will always get something out of that. So it just depends on what the topic is, and it depends on how comfortable the artists are with the different topics. You know, everybody has their strengths. Some people are really good at cash in and cash out and balancing their books, and they're terrible communicators. Others are great communicators, but they have trouble with the financial piece. So I feel like there's always something somebody can get from professional development workshops.
Well, so the reason I asked about that is, you know, as we see things shift, it's not really a hard and fast line between the way things were and the future. You know, the future sort of just happens slowly as we're watching it. And so if there's some evolution, if there's some movement, it happens generally right in front of us, which is why it's not very noticeable at the time. And you mentioned, of course, social media. You know, I remember when the thing was email. I don't have an email address. I'll never have an email address. I believe in personal face-to-face relationships. And of course, if anybody is saying that, we've caught them. We know they're from the past, and they've somehow managed to discover time travel and come forward because no one talks like that anymore. And social media is quickly going that way too. How are you going to make it as an artist if you're not in social media? So this brings up, though, another change, another evolution. You talked about the need that artists often have for a legal primer every year. And of course, you know, that's not something that exists traditionally as common knowledge among artists. So are there opportunities, you think, for stronger collaboration between artists and art professionals, business and industry professionals that don't yet exist? And what do we need to do to get there?
Absolutely. I think there is a niche business that some entities are definitely stepping in to fill, but it really has an opportunity to grow, and maybe even particularly here in New England, which is for those professionals and for those organizations or entities, businesses, who really do understand that nexus of the arts and business. So you were asking about partnerships between arts and businesses, but I really feel like there is, as of yet, an evolution to take place where there is more of a marriage between the creative approach to being a business and not just artists learning to be better business people, but even having the arts change our understanding of what business is. Artists should be revolutionaries. Artists are change makers, and artists see ways to do things that are not your typical way of doing things. So I think having artists, you know, have to think more like business people is not necessarily our goal. I think creative thinkers can see how the arts function, can see how creative minds work, can see how the creative process happens, and can change the way we think about business so that there's almost a new prototype, something that's not exactly arts as usual and something that's not exactly business as usual. And some places, like I feel like Creative Capital, are really trying to explore that territory and push those boundaries, but I think there's still a lot more potential. And I think creative minds are the ones who are going to push that realm so that maybe it won't even have the name professional practices or arts businesses. It's something else. And it's not just about getting rich, and it's not just about being famous, or it's not just about selling. It's It's really a different thing altogether, and I feel like artists are the ones who can help figure that out.
Well, it's interesting, you know, in your comments, there's a caution against sort of top-down approaches to, you know, we're gonna be messianic, we're gonna bring you the gospel of business and bring it to the world and convert the artists. In essence, you know, it's collaboration, it's a more even set of relationships that has been working for us, at least at Clark Healings Fund. So we started with interviewing the artists and capturing the problems they really wanted to solve. And they were a little bit different as we began the pilot for our educational program. They were a little bit different than what we thought they ought to want to solve or thought that they would want to solve. And that difference has made all the difference in our program, that it's not top-down, it's sort of inductive, it's coming from the artists themselves. And what's interesting is that, you know, the way in which they phrase or structure problems teaches us to think in slightly different categories than we might otherwise do. So to turn that back to you, I would say, so we have this pilot program, our Business Accelerator Workshops. As someone who's done these kinds of workshops in person, you know, what other than don't be top down, what other advice do you have for us?
Well, I think similar to what you just said, you know, gleaning from artists what they need is a wonderful approach. But I feel like sometimes when I even, for a time, I was giving sort of these 101 professional practices workshops throughout New England. And when I would do those, I felt like a good presentation to artists was, number one, to give them an overview as much as possible of the totality. Here's all the things you could possibly think about if you are an artist who's really interested in running your own arts business. And that really is, you know, legal, financial, marketing, creating a plan, you know, just where do you want to be in 5 years? Giving them sort of an overwhelming overview. And you make that brief because it can, as I said, be overwhelming. But then once you've done that, then you can really sort of tease out of each person what their strength is. And you can do that through leading questions or finding out what they already have experience in. And sometimes you can just tell from spending time with somebody or getting their questions where their strengths lie. And you can suggest to them areas where they might start to try to run their own affairs. So if they're a very social and bubbly person, or if they love to send emails or, you know, something like that, you say, you know what? Don't worry about the accounting part right now. Just keep doing whatever you're doing with that. Why don't you try doing, you know, a monthly email blast and talk about how to do that? Just get their feet wet in one thing. And then once you do that, then they can take baby steps. And once they get confident, maybe in some marketing that they didn't know they were going to be good at, then you can move on to the accounting piece, and maybe then you can get them to think about their legal issues. And another important thing I didn't mention before, part of being a smart business person is also knowing what you can't do. So once you empower people to figure out what the things are that they're good at, you can also empower them to hire somebody to do the pieces that they can't do, or to maybe trade with other professionals on pieces that are just not their strength. So that would be my approach, an overview, then allow them to pick and choose what their strengths are, focus on those, and then figure out what to do with the other pieces.
Well, so let me ask you the key question then. If we're talking about an artist-driven educational program, in areas where artists often feel uncomfortable getting education, the logical question is, do you think that artists really want to further develop their businesses, or that this is simply a push from organizations like RISCA, Clark Healings Fund, and others? Which is it?
So I would say that one of my biggest concerns when I was creating our program was not to waste anybody's time. Because none of us have time to waste, and of course artists have that problem beyond most people, because not only do they need to be on top of their technical and business affairs, but they need to be making art. And if you have a family on top of that, I mean, time is precious. So I would say that all of us have the same goal, which is that we want artists to succeed. And so the challenge to organizations like Clark Hewling and to arts councils who have these programs is to make sure that you are tailoring a program to artists in such a way that it is absolutely giving them the targeted resources they need without wasting their time. So for me, it took some time to figure out which of my workshops were not useful to artists and to try to cut those out and just give them the resources that seemed like they were very valuable. And I feel like the Assets for Artists program at Mass MoCA does a wonderful job of that. They've been doing this long enough that they know which workshops are really valuable and really useful. And then they give artists a lot of support, again, to try to maximize the value of their time. So I don't know that there's a push coming from one way or another to make, you know, professional practices for artists happen, but I do know that we all have the same goal, which is for success. And then I would say it behooves us as service providers to make sure that we are really honing in what we do to give artists the best services possible.
What do you think are the various roles of local arts councils versus, say, museums like Mass MoCA versus academic institutions like Brown?
That's an interesting question. Actually, right before I left the Arts Council, which was about a week ago, I am brand new at Brown University, I created, in partnership with the Rhode Island School of Design Museum, a Professional Artists Education Expo Day, which I'm hoping they will pick up the ball and run with it for fall. And, you know, I feel like all of these institutions are exploring their roles. Museums are trying to become more service-oriented, making sure they're relevant to artists in their communities, and I think more and more exploring workshops as a part of that. And, of course, arts councils exist for the sole purpose of being resources for artists and arts organizations. And museums often are constituents of arts councils as well. So we're all in the same realm, you know, universities, museums, arts councils. We're all trying to be a resource to build the arts to be as vibrant and successful and as wonderful a part of our world as we know that they can be. And the mechanisms for making that happen is something that we're always playing with. You know, we're always pushing and pulling our programs to be as effective as they can be. So maybe our professional development programs of today will change drastically in upcoming years. I'm not sure. But giving people opportunities for learning, I think, is really a wonderful thing to do. And artists who want to take advantage of that, I think they always benefit. Learning and growing your experiences is always a worthwhile thing to do.
Now, I'm going to pivot and ask you about three different areas of arts business education for artists, namely crowdfunding, networking, and then grants, competitions, and residencies. But before I do that, I want to mention once again, if you're finding value in what you're hearing in this show, a gift of $15 per month lets you sponsor our ongoing broadcast. Visit clarkhewlingsfund.org/thrive to continue bringing content like this to the public. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Christina, your workshops deal in part with sources of funding for artists, including, you know, alternative sources like crowdfunding. So tell us more about how artists can use crowdfunding to support their business and artistic goals.
I had brought in one of the founders of Rocket Hub to run a workshop early on in Rhode Island's professional development program, in RISCA's professional development program, and he did such a wonderful job of talking about crowdfunding in a way that really opened my mind to it. Mind you, this is some years ago, and now crowdfunding has become much more common. But it's not as common as you would think. We in creative communities probably get emails from friends all the time who have crowdfunding campaigns, but that doesn't mean people in other communities necessarily know about crowdfunding. So it's a good thing to jump onto, because I know I get, you know, 10 emails a week about somebody's creative project that they're seeking funding for, and I just can't possibly give to all of them. But, you know, maybe your parent's friend who, you know, your dad golfs with, maybe he's never gotten a crowdfunding pitch before, and if you send out your call soon, people will find it a very novel and fascinating thing to do, and they won't feel overwhelmed by it. It'll still be fresh, but that's not going to be the case forever. Crowdfunding continues to grow. So Rocket Hub came and taught a workshop and got me to think about crowdfunding in a way that was not just about raising money. Crowdfunding is about dedicating a specific period of time, usually about 4 weeks, to promoting the work that you're doing. So find the right project. It's not just your everyday work. Find the right project to crowdfund for, and think of it as an investment in building your audience. And think of it as a challenge. It's almost like a little challenge grant where you will devote a specific period of time to hopefully reaching a dollar amount, but also to really connecting with people, telling people about yourself, and getting them excited about what you do. And if you can do that, if you can dedicate that time to a crowdfunding campaign, whether it's Rocket Fund or Rocket Hub or Kickstarter or Indiegogo, there's so many of them. If you can dedicate your time to that, then you can have exponential benefits well beyond just making a certain dollar goal.
Now, you know, I use the term alternative funding, but really crowdfunding has gone mainstream. So are there other alternative funding sources that are following the same trajectory? And now, how have new funding sources really changed the game?
You know, there's so many things that come and go. I know here in Providence for a time we had a local event called Provisions, where a group of artists, my husband was one of the founders of this, would throw a dinner together, and everybody would pay to come to the dinner, and people would come up and pitch their proposals, usually artists, but not always artists, about something they wanted to make happen, and then the funds from the dinner would go to fund that project. And there's so many things like this happen. People want to see exciting projects go forward, and people want to support the work of entrepreneurs and creative thinkers. So always keep your ear to the ground for those things, and maybe you can even think of ways to create events or collective funding schemes, you know, to help people do their projects, revolving funds. But I would say, and the Awesome Foundation is another one that comes to mind. There was an Awesome Foundation here in Rhode Island, and I know there are in many other states where professionals get together and they have a $1,000 pot for projects that they think are interesting. So sometimes you have to have your ear to the ground for those. Sometimes a Google search can find those. The Foundation Center, foundationcenter.org, is a wonderful resource, and they have so many different funding sources for artists and organizations, of course, but they have a whole section that's just for individual artists, and poking around in those will tell you a lot. And then I also always recommend to artists, check the website of artists who are doing work like yours, and look on their sites, look on their CVs, and see if they've received funding from some resource that you've never heard of before. Because if somebody you're interested in is getting funding from a source that you've never heard of, it might be a good resource for you as well if your work is compatible.
You know, I've read artists' proposals in crowdfunding sources. My question to you is, do you think that artists need to have marketing skills in order to use crowdfunding successfully?
I'll say this. You have to be prepared to dedicate yourself to the project. So that's the benefit of crowdfunding. If you tell somebody you just need to do X, Y, and Z for marketing all the time, it just gets overwhelming. Crowdfunding is a nice little starter kit to get you into the mindset and the practices of marketing yourself. So I think all the crowdfunding platforms have really great tutorials. They have great examples of other kinds of gimmicks or gifts or, you know, advertising that artists and other projects have used to promote their crowdfunding campaign. It's a piece of time you'll cut out for yourself to learn how to do your own marketing and to learn how to build your audience. And if you keep your dollar amount reasonable, you know, I know like Kickstarter requires you to meet your goal, so don't set your goal at $60,000. You know, make your ask, you know, $4,000 or something attainable, and then you won't have lost anything by doing the campaign. Hopefully you'll make a little money, but really take it as a learning experience and an experimenting experience and see how you do. And at worst, you'll have found something out.
Yeah, I mean, it's common for people to set a huge goal and then sort of panic as they get toward the end and maybe even try to borrow money and fund their own project. And it's probably more effective to do something I've seen, which is to do a modest initial campaign. And then when you've met that campaign, fire up campaign two on the strength of campaign one. You know, well, we've raised $4,000. What I'd like to do is also cover these costs and go for 15, et cetera. I want to shift, though, and ask you about networking as a marketing strategy, as an integral part of an artist business. You know, so often networking events kind of feel like they're just fluff. We're hobnobbing over a few glasses of wine, but we hear artists say that it takes them out of the studio, and at the end, they don't have much to show for it. So my question is, how can networking and attending events become a really productive part of an artist business plan?
Well, I would even take a different tack on the whole idea of networking, because you can think of networking in a lot of different ways. Networking can also take place by building relationships with certain people or certain entities. And sometimes when somebody, going back to our crowdfunding issue, if somebody's doing a crowdfunding campaign or they're thinking about it and they're trying to brainstorm how to use their network or how to connect with people, I'll have a conversation with them just asking them, you know, do you belong to any clubs or groups or what do you do on the weekends? Or, you know, for some people, they might even go to church or go to temple or, you know, there's all kinds of things that make up our lives. Do you have kids? Do you belong to parents groups? And suddenly people start to realize that they have a lot of connections with people that they hadn't thought of as their network. It's just life. It's just what you do day to day. And as I start to say to them, you know, oh, you did a 5K run for, you know, your church or whatever it is, you know, maybe send one little email to that group, just one, to let them know that you're doing a crowdfunding campaign, and those people will know you through this other context, and that might get them excited about your artwork. They might not even know that you make artwork. And I would add to that, not just your personal, you know, life contacts, but building relationships with organizations can be such a wonderful way to build both the reputation of your arts career and to expand the group of people who know about you, and in a way to legitimize you in a way that, you know, just day-to-day life doesn't. So if there's some sort of organization you're interested in connecting with, it could be animal, it could be a homeless shelter, it could be that you're interested in animals and animals' rights. I mean, it could be anything in the world that is tied to your personal interests. Offer to get involved in that organization in some way through your artwork. It could be donating a painting to an auction. It could be, you know, they have an upcoming event and you're going to help out in some way. Maybe you're a musician and you want to play your music there. And those organizations can be so appreciative of your connection with them that, again, if you have a crowdfunding campaign or, you know, let's say you did play music for an event, maybe in exchange you want your name in the program. People who come to that event, maybe donors or board members, if they know who you are, they might get interested in your work. So, you know, going to a dinner party is always great. Going to a bar is always great. Be sure to talk about your work. Always let people know what you do. But I think there's also really substantial ways that you can connect with people and let them understand what you do as a creative person.
Okay, so then let's finally talk a little bit about grants, competitions, and residencies. So some artists will say that they won't apply for grants and competitions that charge a nominal fee for entry. So what do you think? Is that a wise limitation to impose?
There are all kinds of listservs that you can get on, you know, the Arts Deadline List, callforentry.org, that's a really great one to sign up for. There's a lot of platforms you can sign up for that'll send you notifications about competitions and maybe public art calls or other opportunities. It's always great to sign up for those. And then, of course, it's buyer beware. So some online entries could ask you for proprietary, they might ask you for ownership, you know, that when you win their little award suddenly, you know, they have full access and rights to your images, or, you know, other ones might just not be that great. They might seem great when you just read their two-line description, but you have to really go to their website and ask around to see if it's a worthwhile thing to apply for. So, yeah, really, it's just, unfortunately, it's a matter of research. And sometimes, two ways I would say you can find out more, word of mouth, definitely ask around, ask friends what kinds of competitions they've applied for. Some might be worth the $50 entry fee, and some might not be worth the $15 entry fee. It just depends. And also, again, I always recommend going to websites of artists and arts organizations that you feel are akin to the kind of work that you do, and see what they've applied for, see who's funded them, see what competitions they've won, and that can also help you. The only thing I would add to that is sometimes those competitions that require an entry fee, always look at the juror, because sometimes the juror might be somebody of note that you really want to get your artwork in front of, and that could make the entry fee worthwhile. So I would say that that's a case-by-case basis.
It's good that you mention resources for finding out about competitions and grants. You know, the Clark Hulings Fund has the first North American visual arts calendar that we've released, and it has everything from exhibitions to art shows to arts business classes to grants, competitions, and residencies. And so it's a great resource as well to find these things. And of course, to find that, you would go to clarkhulingsfund.org and simply click on events. But some artists prefer to apply for grants or enter competitions rather than pursue residencies. So maybe that depends on the artist, but how can an artist decide which is more appropriate for their business?
Well, grants and residencies are very different things. You can get a grant to go to a residency, but grants are really either a financial award from something like a state arts council through like a fellowship program that are a cash award for your work. If there's any competition, any fellowship, any award that you can apply for that does not have a fee, you need to get into the habit of applying. I don't care if you apply every year for 20 years and don't get one. You should be in the habit of applying. That's just part of your practice as an artist. It keeps you on people's radar. It makes sure you have your work documented and updated, and it keeps you in the mix. So always, always apply for those. Some grants require that you do a certain set of activities. So your traditional grant is, you know, who, what, when, where, why. What are you going to do with this money? When are you going to do it? Why are you going to do it? Those proposal-based grants are only for some people. That's not for everybody. And, you know, talking to a grants officer or reading carefully about grant opportunities will let you know if that's something that is appropriate to what you're doing. But residencies are really about having time away. You know, residencies are really about retreats, getting out of your current environment to just dedicate your time to your artwork. And I would absolutely encourage people to contact the Alliance for Artists Communities, which is an organization that happens to be based here in Rhode Island, but is an organization of international scope. And they are wonderful people to talk to about whether a residency is right for you, and also which residency is right for you, because they run the gamut from, you know, some local group who has a little shack, you know, out in the woods and wants an artist to just come and stay there for free, to, you know, the McDowell Colony, you know, or to, you know, Yaddo, and these much bigger institutions that it's almost like a certificate program. You know, you go there to work with professional artists and you gain amazing skills and credentials when you come out. So those are very different things, and different people might need them at different points in their careers. And, you know, reaching out to state arts councils or foundations or nonprofits like the Alliance, they can give you that information about which of those are right for you and when.
But now, you know, why should an artist bother with residencies if, I mean, you talked about the necessity of applying for grants that have no entry fee, but why should an artist bother with residencies if they can just work from their studio at home and still receive funding?
That really depends on you. So as I said, you know, some residencies are just a time away. And for some people, that time away might be taking 2 weeks off of their day job just to be in their studio. And that's legit. But some residencies are really about taking you out of your current environment and putting you maybe in a specific other environment. Maybe being by the ocean is going to inspire you, or maybe you live in the city and being out in the middle of nowhere, you know, where there's not the sounds of the city is what you need. But again, some residencies really are extremely professional experiences where, you know, the Vermont Studio Center is very close to us here in Rhode Island. And my husband, Neil Walsh, he did a residency at the Vermont Studio Center years ago. And we connected, me as well as him, we connected with artists who we're still friends with. And he has done partnership programs and brought them as visiting artists to AS220 where he works. That can be a wonderful networking experience when you're at some of those bigger institutions. So it really just depends on the specific need of the artist. I have had artists come to me at the Arts Council who have said, like, I just need a month of time away to focus on my art. And they were coming to me for a grant. And I said, you know, you don't need a grant. You need a residency. And it might be worth it for you to pay the fee, or you might contact that residency and see if they have some scholarship opportunities. Again, the Alliance for Artist Communities is a wonderful resource for finding out about funding that's available for residencies if that's what you need in your practice.
Well, now as we wind down the show, I'm going to ask you two or three just sort of light, fun questions. I want to start with something a little bit personal, though, because of the change in jobs. So what do you hope to carry over from your role at RISCA to your new role at Brown University?
Well, RISCA was a wonderful place to work, and I was so lucky to connect with so many artists around the state of Rhode Island and regionally through that job. And to come to Brown University from the state really is, it's a different atmosphere, I have to say. I used to say to people that I was in the belly of the beast so that the artists didn't have to be. The state is a very, can be a very bureaucratic and sort of insular place to work, whereas Brown, you know, just feels like this incredibly dynamic and culturally enriching place to be. I'm actually looking at a group of students right now who are all on their laptops doing summer programs and sketching and drawing and talking about art, and so it's just this dynamic place, and I'm hoping that all of the internal knowledge that I have and the experience that I have with arts organizations and professional artists, that I can help both the students and the faculty, you know, shape their programs, run their programs, work with their students to just, you know, usher them into that world of being professional artists, usher the students into the world of being professional artists, and then also help the faculty give them the professional services that I was able to give to artists statewide for so long. But Brown is really, it feels like an exciting place to be. So I hope I can be an enriching part of this environment, because it's a pretty amazing institution. So I hope I'm able to bring something of value to it.
So if you could have one technology or superpower to do something that you're currently not able to do with your art or career, what would that be?
One technology or superpower. I think I would love to get away from, so often I feel like in the work that we do, like, we struggle with the minutia, and I think this goes back to our professional development, you know, questions about making workshops relevant to people. I know technology is trying to streamline things and make things easier for us, and I would hope that I could just sweep us all past that, you know, so that everything, all the day-to-day riffraff was as easy as possible, and then we could just really focus on enriching conversations and enriching experiences and beautiful environments so that, you know, life just felt a little bit more enchanted. I fear that the day-to-day minutiae is just necessary. I don't think it exists as one's problem-solving technology or as a superpower. But if magically I could make that happen, I would have all of the nitty-gritty, difficult day-to-day things just magically take care of themselves so that we could really have sort of more in-depth, creative and magical experiences.
Okay, and lastly, what is the greatest challenge facing working artists today?
I think the greatest challenge for working artists is really a challenge that is not just for artists, it's for all of us. We are in a very complex world, and nothing is guaranteed. So how you plan and how you secure things for yourself, it's hard. And again, it's not just artists, it's for people in all industries. We hear so much about the stratification between wealth and poverty and struggles of the middle class. That is the case for everybody. So I wish everybody the best, because it seems like we all have to be multitasking and reinventing ourselves. But the beautiful thing is that artists can present themselves in the world as people who are there to bring pleasure and new experiences and aesthetics and beautiful music to the world. So even if you have to struggle to make sure you're on top of your finances or, you know, to figure out social platforms, at the end of the day, you are so lucky because you allow yourself to take time out of that and explore your creativity and how your creativity can enrich the world. And there's nothing better than that. I was just at a concert here in Rhode Island the other day of our friends Atwater and Donnelly, who are a folk music duo. And just to be able to take an hour out of my day to sit in a park and listen to them play music, they were paid. It was a gig. The town had paid them to be there. And I sat there thinking about, this is what they do. You know, they perform these old-time folk tunes, and they talk about them. And they have to do the booking, and they have to do the advertising, and they have to do the touring, and they have to maintain their equipment. There's so much they have to do to keep that career going. But then there's that hour where they are just playing music in the park and we were all enjoying it. And that's the gift of the arts, is that you give people that experience.
You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. Christina recommends reaching out to your own state arts council to get on their radar. And for more information on the Clark Hulings Fund and our Business Accelerator program, visit clarkhulingsfund.org. Be sure also to follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Christina. It's been really great having you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being on the show, and good luck to everybody in their arts careers.